Okay, well, here's the point where I usually say turn with me, if you will, to the beginning of this week's Torah portion, which is chapter 19 of Bamidbar in the wilderness, or the book of Numbers, because there's a lot of them in here, especially in the beginning. But in this case, we're talking about the parsha that is called Chukat, and it begins, as so many of them do, with the words that don't count for the name of the portion, because it says, "And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and unto Aaron, and he said the following, This Zot Chukat HaTorah, this is the statute, or the Chukat of the Torah, which Yahuwah has commanded, saying the following." Now, we'll pause right there and talk about a couple of things before we get started on this, because most folks will know when they hear the name of the portion, if they've been through it a few times, that, oh yeah, this is the famous red heifer hook. And you've probably also heard it said that the wisest man who ever lived, Solomon, is said to have remarked that he didn't quite understand, couldn't wrap his head around this one. And there are a lot of reasons for that. There's a whole lot about this this hook or hukat that doesn't make a lot of sense to us. But nevertheless, in a lot of respects, it's fundamental. And in this way too, because the hook of the red heifer has a lot to do with this concept of death, and we see a lot of death in this portion as well. It is really, I think, vital to at least try to understand what this is talking about. So let's go through it, see if it doesn't begin to make a certain amount of sense. Now, by the way, there's one other thing I'll mention about a hook. Some of you know or remember that there are a couple of different words that are used in the Hebrew that have the meaning of different aspects of law. One of them is hook, or plural hukim, that is often translated as statutes. These are the things that essentially we don't necessarily understand. We get to some of the other ones that are called mitzvot and mishpatim, and then they get progressively a bit easier, right? Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill. Well, okay, I can relate to thou shalt not kill because I just assumed somebody didn't do that to me. Thou shalt not steal. If I don't do it, I just assume nobody did that to me either. So there are certain things that we say, okay, that's fairly clear. But when it comes to the red heifer and what the red heifer does and how that works, yeah, it's definitely in the category of a hook because we just don't know. And with that in mind, I guess one of the ways of describing the hook are these the words, because I said so. You can think about a number of things that are called hukim. Perhaps the first one in Scripture, and at least nowadays it makes more sense in hindsight, but it may not have made quite as much sense at the time when it was issued, the single commandment or statute that that Adam and Chava were told about. And that's there's all this stuff in the garden. You can eat anything except this one or these two. This tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Don't eat that one. Why? Well, because I said so. He does say, because if you do eat from it, you'll die, but that's not so much a reason for, well, I guess it's a good reason for not doing it, but it certainly doesn't explain to us why it is that it has that characteristic, if that makes sense. Okay, back to this idea of the red heifer. This is the statute, the hook, hukat, which Yahuwah has commanded, tell the children of Israel, they should bring you a red heifer, faultless, no blemish. And it has never known a yoke, never been put under the yoke. You're going to give this heifer, give her to Eliezer, the priest. By the way, heifer is parah adomah. Parah adomah. It's kind of a nice sounding word. In a lot of respects, maybe it makes better poetry than a red heifer. Anyway, give her to Aaron, or to Eliezer, the priest. Bring her outside the camp, and she will be slain before his face. Eliezer is going to take her blood, sprinkle the blood towards the front of the tent of meeting 7 times. She is burnt. Everything. Skin, flesh, blood, dung. All of it's burnt. Then the priest takes cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet, puts it, casts it into the midst of the burning of the heifer, and then some of the unusual stuff, the stuff that doesn't make as much sense, starts. Priest is to wash his clothes, take a bath, mikvah. Afterwards, he may come into the camp. But for that, he is unclean until the evening. And then he that burns her shall also wash his clothes in water, bathe his flesh in water, and also be unclean until the even. And the man that gathers up the ashes of that red heifer and takes them up outside the camp to a clean place where it's kept for the congregation of Israel, the children of Israel, for a water of sprinkling for purification of sin, well, this guy too, he shall wash his clothes. He is unclean until evening. And this will be to the children of Israel and to the stranger that sojourns among them another statute, le'huchat olam, forever. So we got several folks. Basically, anybody that has anything to do with the red heifer becomes unclean. But if we scan ahead and see what the point of the red heifer is, the parah adumah, it is to make things clean. So here's part of the thing that I'm sure flummoxed old Solomon, Shlomo, just a bit. And that is, hey, how is it that it makes people who are formerly clean, unclean, and yet the purpose is to make the unclean clean? That kind of seems a little bit backwards, doesn't it? And then we get to this. Verse 11, he that touches the dead, any dead man's body is also unclean for 7 days. And he needs to go through a certain ritual to purify and clean himself back up again. On the 3rd day and on the 7th day, he is to wash himself, purify himself. If he doesn't do that, he is not clean. So he's got to do it both on the 3rd day and the 7th day. Otherwise, he ain't clean. Whosoever touches the dead, the body of a man that is dead, and does not purify himself, he has defiled the tabernacle of Yahuwah. And that soul is cut off from Israel, because he did not wash the water of sprinkling against him. He remains unclean. His uncleanness is upon him. This, it says, is HaTorah, the instruction. When a man dies in a tent, everyone in the tent, everyone that comes into the tent, everything that is in the tent is unclean and remains unclean, basically, for 7 days. Anything that was open, any open vessel that didn't have a covering over it, I think of it, it's almost like they understood germs or something. There's an aspect of death that might literally permeate those things that are open vessels. So any open vessel that didn't have a covering, it's unclean. Whoever's in the open field and touches someone that's slain, whether it's by a sword or somebody that died on his own, or the bone of a man, or a grave, all of those things make a person unclean for 7 days. And for the unclean, they'll take the ashes from the burning of the purification from sin, running water, put into a vessel. Clean person takes hyssop. We've seen hyssop before, right? This was the same thing that was used to as a paintbrush, if you will, to put the blood over the doorpost. Now it's hyssop that is going to be dipped in this water of purification, sprinkled it upon all of the things that had to do with this dead person. The tent, the vessels, anything that was in there, any person that was in there. Or same thing goes for somebody that touched a bone or somebody that was slain in the field or a grave and so forth. And a clean person shall sprinkle upon the unclean, as we've just said, twice, on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. On the 7th day, he shall purify him, wash his clothes, bathe himself in water, and then, what, at evening, when the evening comes, he shall be clean. But the man that doesn't do that, his soul is cut off, because he has defiled the sanctuary of Yahuwah. Water of sprinkling has not been put on him. He is unclean. This, too, it says, is a statute, le'huchat olam. He that sprinkles the water of sprinkling needs to wash his clothes, and anyone that touches the water of sprinkling is unclean until evening. Anything the unclean person touches is also unclean. The soul that touches him is unclean until evening. So let's pause and see what is going on here. And what is kind of fascinating are all the contrasts and the opposites that are involved. And literally, I guess the one theme that clearly so far, and by the way, we're just getting started, permeates this portion is this idea of death. And if you think about it, it makes perfect sense in a lot of respects. Death is the opposite of life. The Torah is all about life. The primary choice that we're told is choose life. And we know that there's something, there's something clearly unclean about death, tamei. And it has this characteristic that it contaminates everything that comes in contact with it, it would seem. Needs this this water of purification to kind of wash that taint off. But there's more to it than that. And I guess that's the part that even when you look back and say, okay, what did Shlomo begin to understand? I think probably part of this, I'm sure it was clear that the connection with death was something that was fairly obvious. Maybe even the fact that there's an opposite that goes on here. But again, well, why, for example, a red heifer? Why the emphasis on the clean and the unclean and death? Well, maybe that too is fairly obvious. Again, the whole of the book, starting with that first commandment that we already talked about, is about life. And it's about removing the stain, the taint, the infection, that is death. And had it not been for the need to do that, of course, the book would have been really short, as I've liked to joke about for a long time. Could have been all over in chapter 3. One of two things. Either, and they lived happily ever after, or he didn't have a plan and he just whacked them. But he didn't. He did have a plan. He knew the end from the beginning. And somehow or other, it's clear that this concept of life and death is not only fundamental, but somehow the Parah Adumah and the things that are at the heart of this portion would all seem to fit together. Let's continue and see if it doesn't make a bit more sense. How about chapter 20? And the children of Israel, even unto the whole congregation. So this is the B'nai Israel, and it's all of them. It's Kol Ha'edah, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month. People abode in a place called Kadesh, and here's more death. Miriam, sister of Moshe and Aaron, died there and was buried there. There was no water for the congregation, it says in the next verse. And they assembled themselves together against Moshe and against Aaron, and they did what we have come to expect. They whined, and they strove with Moshe. As a matter of fact, the names of these places have this understanding of quarrel. Quarrel is at hand. So they did. They quarreled with Moshe. They spoke and they said, "Would that we'd perished." Oh, good grief. How many times we heard this? "When our brethren perished before Yahuwah." The standard understanding of this is that it's been almost 38 years. We're pushing now towards the end of the time frame. And certainly that's clear because we know that Aaron is going to be the next to pass. So we're almost at the end of the wilderness time, or at least this phase of the wilderness time. And it's not the first time we've heard this, and by this time it would seem, because of the way they phrase this, that most everybody who was fixing to die, all of those who were around at the first recorded vote in human history with the spies, have now perished. So the ones that are left are saying, "Would that we had perished," kind of like they're saying, "perished also, when our brethren perished before Yahuwah." And why, they whined, "have you brought this assembly of Yahuwah into the wilderness to die here, along with our cattle? Why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? No seeds, no figs, vines, pomegranates. Now we're out of water too. Got no water to drink." So it would seem that Moshe and Aaron have heard this whining before. And honestly, as we go through the Torah, it seems to me like it's difficult to keep track of all the times we've heard a similar refrain. Those little violins playing, right? The note of whining out there in the wilderness. And it's not the first time that Moshe and Aaron have been kind of upset, but this one is going to be a little bit different. Moshe and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly. They went to the door of the tent of meeting. They fell upon their faces, and the glory of Yahuwah appeared to them. And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said the following. Now listen carefully, and I'm going to make mention again of this idea of a hook, because I think it's going to help set up this part of the story. Most folks probably know what's going to happen. This is to a large extent, a tragedy. And the reminder, what's a hook? A statute. It's something that you do because I told you to. Because I told you so. You don't have to understand why, just do it. Here's Yahuwah speaking to Moshe, and he says, listen carefully, "take the rod, symbol, the congregation, the kahal, you, and Aaron, your brother, and speak, speak unto the rock before their eyes, that it give forth its water. And then you shall bring forth to them water out of the rock, so that you can give the congregation and their cattle, all of them, water to drink. So Moshe took the rod from before Yahuwah as he commanded him. So far, so good, right? Then Moshe and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock. Again, so far, so good. And he said to them, wait a second. Hear us now, you rebels! Are we going to have to bring forth water out of this rock? Whoa. Okay, already there does seem to be, and what you'll hear people say is, well, this doesn't seem like that big of a deal. Isn't this pretty tough, what's fixing to happen to Moshe for this little thing? But on the other hand, and I preface this by saying clearly Moshe is upset. They've heard this whining before. How many times are they going to have to go through this? You can hear his frustration. It comes through here. But the way that they're addressed, you rebels, we just had the incident with Korah, at least Torah description-wise, and maybe that's still fresh in folks' minds, even if it was a while earlier. Who's going to bring forth the water? Are we to bring forth water out of this rock? So Moshe lifted up his hand. Now, he's supposed to take the rod. So far, so good, right? But in this case, he lifts up his hand. He does not do what he's supposed to. It said, speak to the rock. Instead, he smote the rock with his rod. Now, wait a second. That's bad enough. He didn't smite it just once. No, he whacked it twice. And water came forth abundantly, and the congregation drank, as did their cattle. And then we get the inevitable response, the comeuppance, if you will, to the failure to listen. What's the point of a hook? Hukat? Because I told you so. What did Moshe do? Well, he did something. And you could say, well, wait a second. He smote the rock before. That worked before. Why doesn't it work again? Well, it kind of did work again. But again, it was not what he was told to do. And the key does seem to be, because I told you so. You weren't listening. Yahuwah says to Moshe and Aaron, because you did not believe me to set me apart to sanctify me, literally to, and I'm going to twist the Hebrew badly here, the word, remember, to set apart, sanctify, kadosh. So, to sanctify, to kadoshify me. Leha kodeshni. Because you didn't do that before the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore, you are not going to be the man that brings this assembly into the land which I have given them. These, therefore, are the waters of Meribah. Meribah, again, this root word, strife or contention. Where the children of Israel strove before Yahuwah. And he was sanctified in them. Just not the way that he was supposed to be, by the mouth of Moshe and by his action of speaking, not whacking the rock. So Moshe sent messengers at this point forward. Wait a second, we've got a sudden change of gear here. Let's pause one more time. I'd like to look at some of the context and say, what is it, right, in this Torah portion that kind of represents a continuing theme? Well, obviously one of them is the red heifer and its association with life and death and cleansing, the clean and the unclean, opposites. And it does, seems to have this power or this somehow understanding to turn things that are related to death back into life and to take things that are unclean via association with death and clean them up again. But in the process, it has the reverse effect on those that are involved in the process. Now here we have another set of bookends. We've got Miriam dying first. And some of the sages say, well, maybe this helps also explain part of the reason why Aaron and Moshe are a bit short-tempered. And that's understandable. Miriam's gone. But now we're going to get another couple of items. We see all of a sudden here, after the incident with the rock and smiting it twice, somebody else is going to die. But before that, we have this quick story about the Edomites. Moshe sends messengers out, sends them to the king of Edom, says, hey, here's what your brother Israel says. You know all the stuff that's happened to us, all the travail that has befallen us. How our fathers went down to Egypt. We dwelt there a long time. They dwelt ill with us and our fathers. We cried out to Yahuwah. He heard our voice. He sent forth a messenger, brought us out of bondage and Mitzrayim. Behold, here we are. We're hanging out in Kadesh, a city in the literally the outskirts of your borders. So here's what we're asking. Just let us pass, I pray you. They ask real nicely, through your land. We will not go through your fields, your vineyards. We won't drink the water of the wells. We'll simply go along the king's highway. We won't turn aside to the right hand or the left till we're outside your borders. Sounds reasonable enough. And then says Edom, nope. You will not pass through me, lest I come out with the sword against you. That's a pretty nasty threat. Children of Israel then said unto him, well, look, we'll go by the highway. If you drink of your water, us and our cattle, we'll pay you for it. For crying out loud, just let us pass through on our feet. No harm will come. Nope, ain't going to do it. You shall not pass through. And Edom came out against him with much people and with a strong hand. Thus it says, Edom refused to give Israel passage through his border, so Israel turned away. And by the way, this sets a precedent that not a pleasant one. So they journeyed there from Kadesh, the whole congregation, they came to Mount Hor, where Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and Aaron in Mount Hor, by the border of the land of Edom. And here is where he says, all right, the second death in the portion. Aaron is going to be gathered unto his people. He too will not enter into the land that I've given the children of Israel, because he, along with you, y'all rebelled against my word there at the waters of Meribah. So take Aaron and Eleazar his son, bring them up into the mountain of Hor, Hahor. Strip Aaron of his garments, put them on his son Eleazar, and Aaron will be gathered unto his people. He will die there. So Moshe did as Yahuwah commanded. They went up to Mount Hor. All of the congregation was watching, and Moshe stripped Aaron of his garments. He put them upon Eleazar his son, and Aaron died right there on the top of the mount, the Har Hor. And Moshe and Eleazar came down. And when all the congregation saw that now it was Aaron that was dead, they wept for him for 30 days. Kol HaBeit Israel, all the house of Israel. Well, we just talked about the Edomites, and now we're going to hear about the Canaanites. The king of Arad down south heard tell that Israel came by that way of Atarim, and he too came out and fought against Israel, took some of them captive. And Israel this time vowed a vow before Yahuwah and said, if you'll indeed deliver this people into my hand, we will utterly destroy their cities. So Yahuwah hearkened to the voice of Israel. He delivered up these Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them in their cities. The place was called Ormah, and they journeyed from there, from Mount Hor, by way of the Red Sea, or that's probably the Sea of Reeds. It usually gets translated Red Sea, to encompass the land of Edom. Soul of the people became impatient because it was a difficult journey. And what do they do? Well, again, they speak against Elohim and against Moshe, and they said, right, you can almost say it with me, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die here in the wilderness? There's no bread, there's no water, and our soul literally hates this contemptible, worthless bread. Ha kalakol. This contemptible, worthless light is how this version renders it, but I like the little bit stronger language. They hate the manna. That's not going to sit well. What's going to happen this time? Yahuwah sends fiery serpents. Seraphim is actually the word there among the people, and they bit some. They bit a lot of them, and many people of Israel died. So the ones that didn't die came to Moshe and they said, we have sinned, you think? Because we've spoken against Yahuwah and against you, pray to Yahuwah that he takes away these seraphim from us. So Moshe did. He prayed for the people. And this time Yahuwah says to Moshe, here's what you can do. Make yourself a fiery serpent, a serpent of brass. And this time it's Nechash, Nechoshet. Poetic. Nechash, Nechoshet, of brass. Put it up on a pole. And it'll come to pass that anyone that is bitten literally looks upon it and will live. So he makes a serpent of brass, puts it up on a pole. Came to pass that if a serpent had bitten any man, when he looked upon the serpent of brass, he lived. Let me ask you a question, because it occurs to me as I'm reading this again, there is so much about this portion, from the red heifer, para aduma, to a brass, or almost kind of a reddish serpent, up on a pole, that there are a lot of death, life, opposite kind of contrasts going on here. This color red, red has an association, of course, with blood and with other things. Brazen altar, lots of references to brass, of the metals that we encounter as we go from the outside to the inside. In the Mishkan, the tabernacle, it goes brass and then silver and then gold. Anybody else think it's a little bit strange that we know that there is a reference to a Redeemer who will hang on a tree and people will look upon him and hopefully understand? And yes, it's all about life. And in this case, we've got, if you think about it, kind of the opposite. Now, seraphim is an interesting word because this too has kind of a connotation associated with some hosts of Hashemayim. But if anything, this idea of an opposite seems to kind of apply here too. We have a Mashiach that hangs on a wooden tree or a stake, and Moshe is making an image of a serpent that is going to hang on a metal pole, serpent of brass upon a pole. But same thing, somebody looks upon the serpent of brass and they live. Interesting. Contrasts, opposites, life, death, blessing, cursing, clean and unclean. Children of Israel now, after all of that, they journey. They pitched in Obot, and they journeyed from there to Ehe Abarim in the wilderness, which is in front of Moab, towards the east, the rising of the sun. And then they journeyed and pitched in the valley of Zered. Then they pitched on the other side of Arnon in the wilderness, coming out on the border of the Amorites. Arnon, it tells us, is the border of Moab, between Moab and the Amorites. Wherefore it's said in the book of the wars of Yahuwah, Vaheb and Sufa, the valleys of Arnon, and the slope of the valleys that inclines towards the Sea of Ar, leans on the border of Moab. From there we have Be'er, from where the well, where Yahuwah now says to Moshe, gather the people together, I'll give them water. So they sang a song, spring up, O well, sing unto it, the well which the princes dig, and the princes of the nobles delved, and the scepter and their staves. Lots more about journeys. Wilderness to Matanah, to Nahaliel, to Bamot, to the valley that's in the field of Moab by the top of Pisgah. It looks down on the desert. And when all of this is in progress, Israel then sends messengers to this king, Sihon. We know his name. Going to hear another name we're going to know in a minute, too. King of the Amorites. And he says something that sounds familiar because it was almost exactly the same thing that was said to the Edomites. Let us pass through your land. We won't turn aside into your fields or your vineyards. We won't drink of the water by your wells. We'll go on the king's highway till we've passed by your border. And guess what? This, too, sounds familiar. Sihon says, nope, ain't going to happen. He gathered all of his people, too, and he went out against Israel into the wilderness, came to Jahaz, and Jahaz fought against Israel, and Israel smote him with the edge of the sword. Lefi Karev. Karev. The edge of the sword. Now, I've made this observation before, not because it's unique to me, but because I've noticed that the sages have pointed this out for a long time. When Israel goes out and whacks on pagans, it is the mouth of the sword, literally, what that word is translated as. Usually it's rendered as edge of the sword, but it literally is the mouth of the sword that, if you will, eats the blood of the pagans or brings forth the blood of pagans. And when Israel has a civil war, brother fighting against brother, it's by the sword as opposed to the lefi, by the edge or the mouth of the sword. So in this case, Israel goes out, fights against these Amorites with the mouth of the sword, smote them, and took all the land from Arnon to the Yabbok, even unto the children of Ammon, even though it was a strong border. So Israel took all of these cities, and they now are beginning to dwell in all the cities of the Amorites, in Heshbon, all the towns along there. And Heshbon, it says, was the city of Sihon, the king who had fought against former king of Moab, taken his land. And then there is a poem about, come ye to Heshbon, let the city of Sihon be built and established. Fire has gone out from there. The lords of the high places of Arnon. Woe to you, Moab, you're undone. O people of Chemosh, he's given his sons as fugitives, his daughters into captivity, unto Sihon, king of the Amorites. But now, the Amorites are undone, and Israel dwelt in their land. So now Moshe sends people to spy out Yazer, and they took the towns, they drove out the Amorites that were down there too, and they turned and they went up to yet one more very famous king. You've heard this guy's name, Og, king of Bashan. He too comes out, all of his people, to battle at Edrei. Now we're told Og was a big dude, right? Had a bed that was about 18 feet long or so, a giant, or at least a son, the sons of the Nephilim. Yahuwah then speaks to Moshe and says, don't fear this guy. I have delivered him into your hand and all his people and his land. Do to him what you just finished doing to Sihon, king of the Amorites. So they did. They smote him, his sons, all his people, and there was none left remaining, and they possessed his land too. So thus ends the Torah portion. And again, as we kind of wrap things up, I'll just mention two or three of the main themes. One, this idea of a huchat, a statute. Why? Why do we do it? Because I told you so. Do we have to understand why or what all the nuance is that's going on here? No. But it does seem that as we begin to see pieces come together and the prophetic fulfillment of so much that's in Scripture, perhaps some of the things that didn't make sense, even to people like Solomon, centuries ago, we'll begin to. But one thing we do know for sure, something about the Parah Adumah, the red heifer, is very much associated, of course, and it says so, with purification, with taking things that are unclean and making them clean. It's a necessity when someone comes in contact with a dead body. Now, interestingly, it says it's a statute forever. We can't do this today, right? Got no red heifer, but hey, we don't have a tabernacle, a mishkan, or a temple, those kind of places to go into anyway. So I guess it's a fair statement to consider that when it comes to the contact with the dead aspects of this, well, it says it's a statute for forever. So consider the implications of that, and this idea of death and life and clean and unclean and all of the things that are associated with that. The rest of the Torah portion kind of bears that out. We've got the deaths of two of the most prominent people in the wilderness, first Miriam and then Aaron, and we have a couple of interesting stories. Why does Moshe not go into the land? Well, because I told you so, because he didn't do what he was told to, and you'd expect that he, of all people, ought to know better. Finally, we have the story of the brass serpent, the fiery serpent, up on a pole, and the fact that those who look upon it live. We know that in later years, it literally becomes an idolatrous artifact, and that once again, things that brought life eventually are turned upside down. So as a physicist and an engineer, I've always found this kind of stuff fascinating. There is much. If you've ever heard the terms in physics, supersymmetry and symmetry, you'll see that there is a whole lot about the way the universe works that has this property of symmetry, of things that are life on one hand, death on the other, clean and unclean, and that there is a kind of a swapping thing. You'll see particles that will reverse their spin. They flip upside down, poles that flip and so forth. So to the extent at least that it's consistent with so much about the way the universe works, I guess we'd have to say that at least shouldn't surprise us. But somehow or other, at the heart of this Torah portion is this idea of death and, of course, cleansing and a restoration of life.